Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
How are you doing there? It's David here on a miserable Dublin evening. It's the podcast, the weekly podcast that tries to make economics a little bit more comprehensible, a little bit less full of jargon, and hopefully a wee bit more relevant for all of us. Now, this week, I want to talk about the link between wealth inequality, Brexit, and populism that we're seeing all around the world. And it's the usual. I'm joined by John. What's the story, man?
Hey, how's it going?
All is good. I have been running around the place this week, like in Egypt.
You've been doing loads of shows and stuff.
Doing loads of shows and loads of gigs. I tell you what, we're just putting Kilconomics to bed.
Oh, yeah.
And that's on the weekend of the 9th of November. We've got some brilliant guests. Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize winner,
brilliant,
is coming
in.
We have the chief economist of the Bank of England, Andy Haldane.
Oh, right.
He signed up to this about a year ago before he knew that this would be the weekend after Brexit. And so he's the guy who's going to have to figure out what's going on. We have Stephanie Kelton, who is Bernie Sanders' economic advisor.
Oh, yeah.
We have an amazing economist called Betsy Stevenson, who was Obama's economic advisor, the head of the Special Counsel on Economics. So we have a huge...
Is anyone on the Trump side?
We have a good few people on the Brexit side, and they'll do the Trump for us.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, because you're right. You always need somebody on the other side.
It's always a great weekend.
It's a great weekend.
I mean, Dan Ariely's down.
Dan is coming again. Dan Ariely, who's just a brilliant guy, and he's going to be Rory Sutherland. You know Rory Sutherland.
Yeah.
And so it's a really good lineup. I'll also be talking to Malcolm Gladwell. You know, the great Canadian.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and that's an event coming up as part of the Dorky Book Festival.
Where's that on?
That's on the Olympia on the 29th of November, which is the day after you and I are starring in Vicar Street.
I'm really looking forward to the podcast festival.
I'm really looking forward. How are you feeling about that?
I'm terrified, but I'm not a... You know me, Mac. I'm a sound guy. I'm a guy who fiddles in the background, but I'm not really a front of mic guy. But hey, you know... Give me a stage, I'll use it.
You'll be absolutely fine once you see the whites in the eyes of the audience.
that's the bit that terrifies me.
Don't worry, you'll be grand. We'll have a couple. I tell you see those cocktails that JM makes for us?
We need lots of them.
We have about six of them before we go on.
Yeah.
Right?
Careful.
Okay. You need that. It's a great combination. You need that, just the combination where the inhibition is gone, the fluency comes back, but you can't tip over.
It's a really fine line.
It's a fine line. You can't tip over into the... And another thing I'm going to tell you about. So it's been a really, really busy week, but like really good week, putting all these things together. We're going to have a lot to talk about. And the great thing is we're going to talk to a lot of interesting people over the course of the next 4 or 5 weeks.
Brilliant. That's brilliant. So come here to me. Brexit this week. Let's do our little Brexit hit, because we're in the last month. Johnson has finally put a proposal together. I'm not sure what to make of it. There seems to be all sorts of reaction to it. And, you know, it's a do or die thing. What do you think? What's your take on that?
Well, I hope we reject it. Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
I was up the north the last couple of days as well. And, you know, my family up there, some of them voted for Brexit.
Yeah.
But I have a real soft spot for the north because of Shannon, because of being married to a northerner. And I think that this idea that you have a Northern Irish assembly that every 4 years will take a vote on whether or not they're in the EU or in the UK. That's what the DUP have kind of inserted. Now, think about the logic of that, right? Northern Ireland needs capital, it needs jobs, it needs prosperity, more than the South, more than the Republic. You know, we have lots of stuff going on. They really need to believe in the future in Northern Ireland. Think about a company. Can you imagine a multinational company say, oh, we're going to invest in that place, but every 4 years we don't know if they're in Britain or in the EU.
Yeah.
Every 4 years we don't know if they're going to be regulations or going to be European or British. Every 4 years we don't know if they're going to have trade barriers or not. Nobody's going to touch the North. So this latest Johnson wheeze will strangle whatever possibility there is of Northern Ireland becoming a normal economy. And I believe, as you know, that one of our responsibilities in the South, one of our many responsibilities, is not just to our own people, but to the future of the island.
Yeah.
This all-island economy, the fact that, you know, this all-island economy is soon to be close to 7 million people. It's quite significant. And I think that we need to protect that, and we need to protect it actually from what I would say is the Brexit DUP angle. So what you want is you want a company like Google or Facebook or Pfizer or one of those big companies saying, I'm going to invest in Newry or Derry or Belfast.
Yeah.
What they need is certainty. What they need is clarity, and what they need is to be able to have what they would call visibility out 10 years. Now, if you say, aha, every 4 years, this assembly in the North is going to determine whether you're European or British yeah. and your tariffs, things, they'll run away. So I see this as, in economic terms, very retrograde from the North. And once it's retrograde for the North, it's kind of retrograde for what we should concern ourselves about in the South. Not what we should, but some of us do. But the second thing, John, is that, you know, what you're seeing playing out is the sort of the end of the Act of Union. And this is what I find very interesting from our big sort of, you know, our historical, philosophical...
Yeah, hang on a second. Just give us, remind us of the Act of Union. Tell us.
Okay, so the Act of Union was in 1801. So Dublin, again, remember what I say, if you walk around Dublin, you see all these amazing buildings, all these extraordinary big boulevards and squares and Georgian buildings and Georgian architecture, really quite magnificent stuff, all built in the 18th century. So from about 1710 to about 1800. During this period, the economy of Ireland was doing actually very well, although... Yeah. And I want to get on to wealth inequality.
Although the
fruits of that economy were going to a small aristocracy. But the ambition in Dublin was very much evident in the architecture. And then, of course, what happens, you have the Napoleonic Wars, you have the American Revolution. The American Revolution, so Thomas Paine, the chief pamphleteer of the American Revolution, started writing in Dublin. Dublin was a hotbed of old school Republican ideas, which subsequently manifested in Wolfe Tone.
All right.
They got their intellectual ideas actually from Adam Smith, the economist, we can talk about it as well, but also this idea of Rousseau, this idea coming from France and from America of liberty, equality, fraternity. And of course, the British couldn't stand that. So firstly, you have the British in 1776 get shaken by the American Revolution.
Yeah.
Second, of course, in 1789, you get the French Revolution, right? This terrifies Britain because both of those revolutions were anti-British. One was the colonial revolution, and then, of course, there was the anti-monarchist revolution in France. The British then become terrified about the United Irishmen and republicanism in Ireland. Then, of course, you have the 1798 rebellion.
Yeah.
The 1798 rebellion scares the bejesus out of Britain because it was actually so violent. You know, we forget that 70,000 people were killed in Wexford.
Wow.
Alone. This is a huge, huge, traumatic.
I remember doing this in history, but I actually don't remember the numbers.
Involved. Numbers are phenomenal.
Yeah.
The numbers are really phenomenal. So, of course, you get Britain panics and says, hold on a second, London cannot indulge the fantasies of Irish independence. Even if those independent people are loyal to Britain and sort of English aristocrats, I always call them Cromwell's lucky NCOs who actually got Ireland after the Cromwellian Wars. Anyway, so 1801, the Parliament in Dublin votes to close itself down. Huge bribery going on underneath, of course, and unify with England. So it's the Act of Union between Ireland and England, 1801.
Yeah.
That followed the Act of Union between Scotland and England, which was 1707.
Right.
So then the United Kingdom, as we know, of Great Britain and Ireland comes into being. So the Act of Union is what is the dominant political status quo through the 19th century, Victorian. And then, of course, you get the rebellion in Ireland in 1916, whatever. What I see in Brexit is the unraveling of the Act of Union.
Yeah.
And it's a big, long historical... I see it in big historical sweeps. And that's why I worry about Northern Ireland, because it's the sort of last festering legacy of the Act of Union. That's why I'd be worried about Johnson and his rather cavalier attitude towards the North, because I believe that Johnson is using the unionists to cement his own ambition,
yeah,
which is to get an election as soon as possible, to drive the Tory party to the right, to drive into the nationalist right, and he becomes a nationalist leader. I think that's his strategy. And in so doing, he's using the DUP, and ultimately he will abandon them, but he'll abandon them to us.
Yeah.
Because we're the people who have to look after them.
So what is Arlene Foster missing here? What is she not getting? Or is it just pure desperation that is blinding her to the economics, the practical economics, as you said, about the needs of Google, or it needs to attract something. I mean, Harland and Wolff went to the wall, but they've since been bought.
They have, but it's going to become a theme park.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an industry anymore. Look, I think that what you have in the North is politicians on the Sinn Féin side as well, not just the union side, who are determined to believe that success in politics is extracting money out of the exchequer in London. That's what they regard success. So I think the more handouts you give a region, the weaker, not the stronger it becomes, the weaker it becomes.
Yeah.
That they have to stand up on their own 2 feet. And ultimately in the North, what you have is the politics of tomorrow, not the politics of next year or the year after.
Mm.
And whatever little victory you have over your neighbour is sufficient.
Yeah.
But of course, what's happening in the North is massive brain drain, particularly of Protestant kids,
yeah,
who go to university in England and Scotland and never come back.
Well, same what happened here in the
'80s. But we turned it around because we did the right thing. I can't see them turning it around at all.
Yeah,
because they're doing the wrong thing all the time.
But what about the European side? Well, you start off saying we should reject it.
Well, I think the Europeans, when you hear about the EU thinks this, it's actually Dublin. At the moment.
Yeah.
I think the Europeans basically are saying, look, you two have a scrap here. You and the Brits. We'll do whatever you Irish people want, whatever you feel is right. We're not going to abandon you. You're members of the club. As a member of the club, whether it's going to inconvenience us or not, we've got your back.
Yeah.
So that's what I think is going on at the EU. But of course, the EU doesn't want to be seen as being the people that say no to Johnson.
Yeah.
Because then he drags them in to the political game that is the next UK election. And that political game is clearly going to be Johnson saying, look at me, I represent you, the people, against the elite. And the elite are the European Union and the government and the judiciary and the media and the intellectuals, and whatever he decides, the southern liberal media. So the European Union are loath to offer him any ammunition.
Yeah.
So what they're doing is they're entertaining this particular British proposal. They're going to be softly. I think ultimately they will reject it. They know that Johnson cannot take the UK out because they have what he calls the surrender bill, which is Tony Benn's son, Hillary Benn's proposal. What will happen then is that Britain will have to get a extension and Brexit will go on until the 1st of January. So we're back in the loop again.
Yeah.
And we, the Irish government, should not give them a way out now. We should just wait. Not least because anything that Johnson is proposing, I think, is damaging to Northern Ireland. And ultimately, that'll be damaging to us.
Yeah.
We're delighted to announce that the Dublin Podcast Festival have debased their currency profoundly by allowing John and I get on stage on the 28th of November, a Thursday, in Vicar Street for a bit of chat, a bit of economics, a bit of malarkey, and hopefully a wee bit of lateral thinking. Join us if you fancy it. Have a gander at ticketmaster.ie. Dublin Podcast Festival, Thursday, 28th November, Vicar Street. See you there. Now, let's talk about wealth taxes, John. I was looking in the United States about Elizabeth Warren, who's emerged as the front runner in the Democratic race for the first time ever. And one of her big ideas is wealth taxes. And it's interesting, we were talking early on about the Act of Union, because I was walking through Dublin yesterday and I was looking up, have you ever in College Green, opposite Trinity College, if you look at the Bank of Ireland building, you notice one thing, all the windows are bricked up.
Yeah. Right? I mean, it's a gorgeous building.
And it's got no windows.
Yeah.
So you think, why is that? There's windows everywhere else. Mm. And you realise there was a wealth tax in the Georgian era called the window tax. And the idea was, it's a really interesting idea, is that people who had windows were rich. So if you think in the pre-electricity era, everything was dark and rich people wanted natural light.
Yeah.
But we in this part of the world have very little natural light. Unlike the Mediterraneans who want shade, we wanted light. So rich people in the Georgian age had massive, massive windows because they wanted to live in that little bit of light that existed.
Yeah.
Whereas poor people lived in dark. They lived in windowless hovels in the dark, particularly the urban poor. So in order to raise money, the crafty Georgians thought, how do we raise money? We tax those people with windows. And they imposed a window tax because only rich people had windows.
Right. What, on the, based on the number of windows
based
or
on the
size
number
of
windows? The size and the number of windows per house. And of course then, people who didn't want to pay the tax, very mean fellas, bricked up the windows.
It's that's really mean.
It's really mean, isn't it? So if you walk around Dublin now and you look at old Dublin architecture, you will find in lots of old Georgian buildings, one window is bricked up.
Yeah.
And the reason one window was bricked up is the tax only kicked in, I think, if you had five windows. So they'd have four windows and brick up one of them and get away with it.
And very often on the top floor, they'd have half-size windows as well.
Like half-size windows as well. But that was architecturally because you didn't need big windows because there was more light up there.
Right, but it was cheaper as well.
It was cheaper. But but if you look around, if you walk around, do your Merrion Square, do your Fitzwilliam Square, do your Stephen's Green, do your all around that, have a gander, and you find bricked up windows everywhere.
Yeah.
And these were incredibly mean Georgian lads who were trying to avoid the tax. Now, it's a very blunt tax avoidance scheme. But what I want to talk about is wealth taxes, because they have been with us for years and years and years. And now wealth inequality is so dramatic. It has become so dramatic in the last 20 or 30 years since the Reagan-Thatcher deregulation of financial markets. I was listening to Elizabeth Warren the other day. She's making this front and center of her campaign. And I get the impression that we are now at a tipping point where wealth taxes will become totally normal all around the world because wealth inequality is so phenomenal. And what I love about economics and politics is the way the pendulum swings through generations. Mm. So the pendulum swung from the 1930s to the 1980s, where wealth taxes were the norm. Then in the 1980s, you have deregulation, you have Mrs. Thatcher, you have Reagan.
Yeah.
Wealth taxes are cut for rich people. Rich people accumulate much, much more wealth. And now I think the pendulum's swinging again. And if you listen to anyone on the left, they are talking about the reinstatement of wealth taxes. And it's interesting because it's the very wealth inequality that drove things like Brexit. So it seems to me that we're at a moment where 2019, 2020, 2021 will go down in history as the period when wealth taxes came back because wealth inequality is so enormous.
So what is the difference then between wealth and income?
Really good question. The best way to look at it is that wealth is what accrues to you. If you are wealthy, your income comes from your assets. So rent, stocks, dividends, and our ownership of companies. So your income every week is coming from an asset. Income, on the other hand, is that your income comes from wages. So you go out to work. So it's the difference between those people who depend on income from assets and those people who depend on income from wages. So if you think about it, wealth gives you income when you're asleep, when you're not going out to work.
Yeah.
And wealth is the accumulation of years and years and years of income.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that on income equality, Ireland and all over Europe, we do really well in trying to minimize the difference between income at the top and income at the bottom. So, for example, there's a thing called the Gini coefficient, which divides the top 20% income by the bottom 20% income. And in Ireland, it's about four times.
Okay.
So the income at the top 20%. However, wealth inequality is hugely different. So what you see is a dramatic increase in wealth inequality at a time when income inequality is remaining quite static. But wealth inequality is what's driving people's sense that they're being locked out of the system.
Right.
And this is what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are going after in the United States. And this is what I believe lots and lots of political movements will go after in Europe.
Okay. But my gut feeling is with the likes of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren and all the rest. We all believe in
and
fair
Jesus
play.
Christ.
Jesus Christ, the man above. But the argument that I keep hearing, particularly from America, is if you keep hammering the entrepreneurs and the businessmen with taxes, then it serves as disincentive for innovation and entrepreneurship.
Again, this is a nonsense argument because, number one, you're not hammering anywhere. What you're talking about is maybe taking a percent or two off the very, very wealthy. Money they wouldn't even notice. Right?
Yeah.
That's the first thing. The second thing is that at a certain stage, the innovation that sparked the initial wealth is many, many years ago. And what actually drives the wealth of many Americans is not innovation or entrepreneurialism. It's access to deals that nobody else has. This is the idea of privilege, that wealth gives you privilege. The third thing is that the most innovative societies...
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In the world are not the United States. If you take Silicon Valley out of America, that one bit, America's unbelievably uninnovative. And as we said about Africa last week, the most entrepreneurial people in the world are Africans, are poor people. So what you have is this fictitious and I think rather mendacious narrative, which is generated by wealthy people, which is that, you know what? We are the cutting edge of innovation. There's very little evidence of that. So for example, in Ireland, the most innovative people, most wealthy people, people who own property. Property is bullshit. Property does nothing.
Yeah.
Innovates nothing.
Yeah.
It's just a captured piece of rent that is amplified by policy. So my sense is that unless we address wealth inequality, we will constantly have extreme politics. And the choice is ours. And of course, the most emblematic version of that is Trump, who represents everything that is the extreme end of wealth inequality. In the United Kingdom, Brexit is a kind of hybrid, but something broadly similar. And unless and until we reduce wealth inequality, it's a natural tendency for people to think, I'm going to vote for the person. I don't have a stake, but I have a vote. And I'm going to vote for the person who says he's going to take back control for me because I feel I'm falling backwards. And the more I fall backwards, the more radical I'm going to become. And that's exactly what is at the root of populism in Britain, in America, and increasingly all over Europe.
And it's ironic that the people who are leading that are the wealthy.
Trump, well, look, Johnson. Look at the United Kingdom. You have Jacob Rees-Mogg, who is a upper-class hedge fund owner, finding common ground with working-class patriots from Sunderland. These people don't realise that fucker will sell their company five times over on the markets and he'll deposit his money in an offshore company. That's what happens.
Yeah, and of course, trying to spread wealth is very difficult.
Precisely.
So it's very hard for people who don't have wealth or assets to actually get on the ladder.
Yes, it is. And even assets that don't generate income, so like a big house that you live in or doesn't generate income, what it does is it confers status, wealth confers opportunity, privilege, access, all these things which are very hard to gauge economically, but we know that they profoundly change people's lives, their life chances, their opportunities, and how they get on. And the reason that wealth inequality has amplified dramatically in the last 10 years is two things. One is, after the 2008 crisis, the world decided to combat the recession by cutting interest rates. And when you cut interest rates, you drive up asset prices.
Right.
So people who depended on assets for their income got wealthier by doing nothing.
Yeah,
because asset prices went up.
Yeah.
So house prices went up, stock markets went up, the values of companies went up, mergers and acquisitions went up, all that stuff, right? So those who already owned assets did extremely well. But at the same time as we reduced interest rates, we also opened the world up to competition globally from China and India. Now, what China and India do is they put a floor on wages. They drag down wages. So what we're seeing at the moment, asset prices are driven up by low interest rates, zero interest rates, but wages are being driven down by hyper competition. So it means that people who depend on wages for their income have seen their income fall, but people who depend on assets for their income have seen their income rise.
Right.
And consequently, you see this big gap emerging between the wealthy and the workers. And this is what's driving, I believe, populism, because what happens is, if you feel you're falling back in society, if you feel there's outside forces that are reducing your opportunity, you turn to politics. You say, protect me.
Yeah, of course.
And then you vote for the guy who says, I'm going to look after you. We're going to take back control. We're going to make America great again. Precisely. It's that elite people. And and so consequently, populism and the radicalization of the youth is being driven by wealth inequality. And the reason the radicalization of the youth has been driven by wealth inequality is because the real vector for wealth inequality is the housing market.
Right.
If you own property in a period of low interest rates, property prices go up and rents go up because that's the income from property.
Yeah.
But if you don't own property, your take-home income goes down because you're spending so much on rents. And think about it demographically, young people don't own property. Middle-aged and older people own property.
Yeah.
So the middle-aged and the older are actually getting richer at the expense of the young. So you've got all this in the mix and it's all driven by wealth inequality.
So when elderly people are downsizing, there's a transfer of wealth to the elderly.
A, there's a transfer of wealth to the elderly, and B, there's a transfer of wealth to their children.
Yeah.
So you get this concentration of wealth.
Yeah.
And the concentration of wealth is a problem. And the reasons are problems. There's four reasons that wealth inequality is a problem, right? The first reason is if you feel that you don't have a stake in society, if you feel you're falling back in society, you will then end up as a totally rational person deciding, I want some of that back. So people need to have a stake in society in order to buy in.
Well, that's completely natural.
And the amazing thing is, the second amazing thing is, if you have a stake, your behavior changes. Now, the most interesting, one of the most, and I read psychology all the time, whatever, one of the most interesting experiments I've ever seen done about the impact of having a stake in society or having a future is the following. In the United States, there was an experiment done not that long ago with 1,000 kids, 1,000 poor kids.
Right.
And 500 of the kids, their parents were given the cash in a fund that they could use for their children's university education. And the other 500 parents were given nothing. And the idea was, what happens? And something amazing happened, and the researchers didn't expect this, that when those children were three, so they were given the money when they were one, and the money couldn't be used until they were 18. So there was no
payoff.
How much,
by the way, do we know?
It was the exact amount of a second-tier American university. So it was the 20 grand a year.
No, I have no idea.
I think it's a lot. It's about 20 grand. Right? So think about this. So, but they couldn't use it until they were 18. And at the age of 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, those kids, both groups, were tested. How they were doing in maths, how they were doing in arithmetic, how they're doing in writing and reading. And by the age of 4, so this is like preschool kids who were just beginning to learn. And then by the age of 6 and 7, the kids whose parents were given the fund began to do better on every single metric than the kids whose parents weren't. And what it was the kids whose parents were given the fund changed their behavior towards their children's education. So they read to the kids at night. They'd sit down and say, have you done your homework? They do counting games, all that stuff.
They recognize the opportunity.
They recognize that they have a future.
Yeah.
And you know, I've always said that that idea that poverty obliterates the future. That's the idea.
Yeah.
That poverty destroys tomorrow. So think about it. If you have a stake in society, your behavior as a parent changes towards your children. And this amplifies the positive impact. But the problem is, it denigrates the negative impact because the kids who don't have a stake are locked out really early. And that's what makes inequality so endemic, that if you don't have a stake, you get locked out at a very early age. That's the second issue. The third issue is that wealth inequality is totally inefficient. One of the great myths of economics, John, and you hear it all the time, is the rich guy creates jobs.
Yeah.
That's bullshit. Rich people actually destroy jobs.
Go on, explain that.
It's a really fundamental kernel of economics. What drives jobs is demand. And demand is lots and lots of people having an average income in their pocket, spending a little bit every day.
Yeah.
That's demand, right? Yeah. Aggregate demand. Think about a billionaire. So a billion is 1,000 million euros, right? If one person owns a billion, the likelihood is he's going to hoard. He can't spend enough of that money.
Yeah, okay? Of course,
So he hoards money, which is why you have loads of wealth managers, because they take rich people's money and they manage it, right?
Yeah.
So rich people hoard money, they don't spend. Imagine that billion euros wasn't held by one person, but was a million people with 1,000 euros in the pocket. Those million people would spend that 1,000 euros, that would generate massive aggregate demand. Aggregate demand generates employment.
Yeah.
So actually, rich people destroy jobs by hoarding money, whereas poorer people who have a higher percent propensity to spend generate much more demand, economic dynamism, and consequently jobs. So massive wealth inequality is profoundly inefficient for generating jobs and tax revenue and opportunity and all that. And then the fourth issue, John, is contrast, that absolute wealth doesn't annoy people. It's the contrast between what you have and what I have. So if you're sitting at home and you see that fella down the road, he's got a new car,
that's going on his Hollyers,
blah, blah, blah. blah, blah. No, do you know what I mean? So it's the contrast. And because of social media, everyone sees the contrast. So in the old days, very rich people hid their money.
Yeah.
You know, when we were kids in Ireland, you know, there's loads and loads of rich people, right?
Yeah, the whole idea of quiet money.
Quiet money. So the rich guy would, you know, be right. Now, of course, it's all this flash bullshit, right?
Mm.
So people are seeing wealth on Instagram. They're seeing people's different lifestyles. They're saying, fuck it, I want that. So the contrast, so all these together, these issues, the inequality, the opportunity, the contrast, the inefficiency, are all fueling political ramifications, which are, I want to vote for the person who's going to take back control, because I've lost control.
Yeah, and so this is what's driving populism.
Precisely.
Okay. Obviously, everyone has a sense of fair play. And wealth inequality, obviously, is something that needs to be addressed. But I think the perception, you spoke about this before, the perception of wealth inequality is a bit skewed.
Yeah, it's interesting, John. About 4 or 5 years ago, I did a documentary on RT about wealth inequality in Ireland.
Mm.
And here's a clip from it. And it gives you a really interesting insight into the difference between perception and reality.
In a poll of 1,000 people, we asked, in an ideal world, if you were to share out the wealth of the country, what would you think is fair or equal? And it's kind of what you'd expect. The richest 20% would have a little bit more. And at the other end, the poorest 20%, well, they'd have a little bit less. And then we asked, how do you think the wealth of the country is actually shared? And unsurprisingly, yes, you thought it was unequal. You thought the wealthiest 20% would have almost 60% of the country's wealth. And the poorest 20%, well, they just have 11%. So that's how unfair you think Ireland is. But do you want to see the reality? You believe the wealth gap in Ireland is bad, but it's worse than you think. So again, this is what we would like it to be. And this is how bad we think it is. And this is the reality of wealth in Ireland. The richest 20% own 73% of the country's wealth. And the poorest 20%, they don't own the 11% you think they do. They own a meager 0.2%. And if you look closer, the top 5%, well, they own almost twice as much as the entire squeezed middle 60% have. And remember, these aren't just economic statistics. These are people, real lives.
And you know what's interesting, coming back from that clip, is that survey after survey after survey shows that Irish people and Americans and British and Europeans believe that wealth inequality is wrong.
Okay, Mac, that's income and wealth. But put some flesh on that, put some numbers on that and tell us how big, how dramatic this is.
Well, the difference in wealth and income is phenomenal. But what we want to focus really on this podcast is wealth, capturing the size of wealth inequality. Now, luckily, Finn McLaughlin is back from Chicago.
Brain box.
He's out in the wilds of Connemara. He's got two sort of gears, it seems. Chicago, Southside Chicago and Connemara. He's back there. He's on the line. He's done the numbers. He's going to give us a lowdown.
Hey, Finn.
Finn, you're back from Chicago. Give us the crack. You out in Connemara?
Yeah, what's the story? Back in Galway, out in the middle of nowhere with shit Wi-Fi. So it's a miracle you can hear me at all.
It's good to have you back. It's good to have you back. Finn, let's get some data. Let's talk about wealth inequality in the United States. What's the headline figures? You don't need to go so granular, but give me the big figures.
Oh, yeah, sure. We love it granular. But yeah, so you see a lot of talk, whatever, it's the Democrats banging on about it because it's campaign season. But just to put it, three facts that are pretty astounding. So the three richest Americans, who are Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, and Bill Gates, own more wealth than the bottom half of the country. So what is over 300 million people in America. So three people own more than 150 million. So that's fact number one. Fact number two, the net worth nearly tripled for the top 1% between 1995 and 2016. Whereas for the middle class, which is still recovering obviously from the financial crisis, has barely moved. And it's been actually negative for the bottom 10% of the wealth distribution. And that's based on research by the Brookings Institute. And then finally, because it's America, you see that everything's split along racial lines and the racial wealth gap has actually widened as well. So the median white family owns 10 times more wealth than the median black family, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah. Now, can I just ask you about, you're living in Chicago. Can I just ask you there, Finn, do you feel that in Chicago, the racial wealth gap, how does that manifest itself?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm based in Hyde Park, which is like in the south side of Chicago, which is, it's changing from wealthy and being around the university to being, I mean, look, I have taxi drivers telling me, no, man, you can't be walking here late at night. Like, but yeah, it's really that stark. And there's a lot of that to do with basically racism that was built into the way American cities were developed. And it's pretty shocking.
And tell me, Finn, now I'm looking at Elizabeth Warren. I'm listening to America. I'm listening about wealth tax. We talked earlier on in the podcast, John and I were joking about the window tax. If you were to tax wealth in Ireland, give me an idea of how much money could be raised from that, with that kind of this aggressive idea of hammering the witch, as you hear American commentators talking about, like just small taxes on wealth, what could you actually generate?
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, first off, I guess it's important to say that there are obviously some problems with the wealth tax in terms of you have to think about liquidity and that people may be wealthy, but they might not have access to that wealth. So it might be in property and stuff that's hard to convert into cash that you would then pay a tax on. But let's ignore that for a second. Let's just look at the figures. So in the first quarter of 2019, this is based on central bank figures and applying those statistics from that 2015 task report, we can see that the top 10% own $415 billion, the top 5% $291 billion, and the top 1% around $115 billion. And that's based on the CSO figures. So that's the lower end. Now, if you were to propose, let's say, a 1% tax on the top 5% based on those figures from the CSO, and assuming they still hold after 5 years, there's good reason to believe that they've actually gotten worse, but let's just run with that. So a 1% tax on the wealth of the top 5% would yield 2.9 billion euro. Now, if you apply that to the top 1%, which is even fewer people, that would still yield 1.14 billion euro.
These are huge figures.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
1% is, you know, you wouldn't notice it if you're that rich.
Well, you'd hope not. But again, you have to caveat this with there's issues around liquidity. There's issues around how do you prevent people from fleeing the country of capital flight. And there's some interesting details in Elizabeth Warren's proposal to kind of combat that, which is something people should definitely read deeper into if they're interested.
Just give me, if you were to impose a 5% tax, just before we go.
The 5% one gets a little bit more exciting. So if you apply a 5% tax rate on the top 5% of the wealth distribution in Ireland, and these again are based on those CSO figures, that would yield 14.5 billion. And now a 5% tax on the top 1%, that would yield 5.7 billion. So again, yeah, huge figures.
That's extraordinary. Listen, Finn, as always, man, it's good to have you home. Enjoy Connemara. Talk to you soon.
Good luck.
Cheers, Finn.
See you later. Bye.
Now, what is really interesting is that humans, all of us, have this really quite sophisticated way of looking at the world, which is people understand their privilege if they're born in the middle or in the upper. And people also feel was, how would I like the world to be if I wasn't myself? So it always finds me, if I walk by somebody who's homeless,
yeah,
or you go to a very poor country, or you see somebody who's down on their luck, deep inside all of us, I think, is a reaction like, how would I like to be if I wasn't as lucky as I am? Because it is luck. And that translates into most people feeling, I want more equality, because you know what? I could be that guy on the street.
Yeah,
and I think it's very deep in all of us. I don't think people are greedy. I don't think people, you know, the economists say, oh, we're full of self-interest. We're not. Actually, we're communitaire. And how that expresses itself is in survey after survey after survey, people feel we should be more equal. And what's driving that is the understanding of the serendipity of life, that it's all luck. You know, you don't have to go to India to figure this out. You walk around the streets of Dublin, you see people who are homeless, you think, you know, fuck it, that could be me. Now, to bring us back, this is why people like Elizabeth Warren, I believe, are pushing an open door, if they can just frame the discussion right, which is, how do we tax wealth? Thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Now, before we let you go, I want to give you a sneak preview of some premium content, which you can access via Patreon.
James O'Brien, ladies and gentlemen.
When I look at the UK and I travel over there, I always remember in not the distant past, Tony Blair won 3 elections with more than 100-odd MPs, more or less from the centre. And when we used to think about the Tory party, it was this one nation, Tories, and they weren't a million miles away from the social democratic Tony Blair Labourites. What has happened to this constituency that up until 6 years ago dominated centre-left, centre-right and delivered governments all the time?
I think that you had a combination of two events that history teaches us will always run like a dose of salts through any liberal democracy, however secure and safe you think it might be. You had the refugee crisis caused mostly by the events in Syria, where we sat on our hands, for good or for ill, And then you had the economic crisis of 2008, caused in large part by the sort of deregulation that came in under Thatcher and Reagan. And then when you've got a population that feels threatened both economically and socially, it is incredibly fertile ground for bad faith actors. Then you throw in the EU, which has been the mother of all scapegoats in Britain for 30 years. So no one ever tackled the truth. No one ever told the truth about the European Union.
If you enjoyed that, you can hear the full episode and much more by joining us on Patreon, which is patreon.com/David McWilliams. See ya.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.